This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter. This week, MacDonald Hastings pays tribute to the late H.G. Wells, and he discusses whether Britain's culture is deteriorating or not.
This is MacDonald Hastings from London. I expect you noticed a week or 10 days ago that H.G. Wells had died in London. But I wonder if the news made the impression on you that it did on me. I didn't know Wells. I only met him but once. And my most intimate personal recollection of the man is that at one time I was wildly in love with his then personal private secretary. I was very, very jealous of the relationship, as one always is in one's teens, and tried hard, I remember, to impress the young lady that there were other fish in the literary ocean, potentially even greater than Mr. Wells. I may even have made a positive suggestion to support my opinion, because at that time, like so many earnest young men, I was so completely under the spell of H.G. Wells's writing that I'd almost persuaded myself that the great man's ideas were my own. But very wisely, Mr. Wells's stenographer didn't share my view on the shape of things to come, and in a shamefully short time, my affections waned, and I discovered a more willing listener in the back row of a review chorus. And I'd forgotten all about it. It was seeing Wells' obituary notice in the papers that brought back to me those burning years of adolescence. And in the summertime of my life, I realized what a tremendous influence that man has had in shaping me personally and my generation. Wells was essentially the young man's and young woman's writer, still is. People of maturer years have always seen the flaws in his message, his impracticability in politics, his petulance overriding reason, his pathetic anxiety to be regarded as a man of science. But to you, Wells is the magician who for many of us first threw open the doors, gave us the exciting vision of the future, our future. In many things, he was startlingly, surprisingly right. He prophesied modern war, he prophesied the atom bomb, the tank, and the plane. And as Bernard Shaw said in his appreciation the other day, he can be said to have fathered the prefabricated house as well. In other things, he was startlingly, surprisingly wrong, especially in some of his political theories. But the fact is that this generation has been weaned on H.G. Wells's writing. His books have been read in more countries by more people than any other author, any other modern author. And not a little of our ideas of the sort of world we all want to make for ourselves today has been inspired directly by Wells's teaching. It was Wells who was the messiah of the doctrine of one world. He coined the phrase, not Wendell Willkie. It was Wells who showed us how the machine should be tamed to make a decent life for everybody. It was Wells's anger, as much as any factor, that aroused the world to the waste, the muddle, the inefficiency of our competitive and acquisitive society. True, Bernard Shaw did the same thing with greater subtlety and sophistication. But it was Wells, with his wonderfully picturesque way of writing, his popular touch, that carried the message into young hands and hearts. His detailed plans for a constructive solution of the world's problem never had or deserved to have a decisive influence. Practical politics wasn't Wells's job. He was the peddler of ideas, the scatterer of spawn that in other people's minds developed and flourished. And to Wells, more than any other writer of our day, we owe such sense of the unity of mankind and the interdependence of its peoples that we have now. The measure of his greatness is that so much that he said for the first time is already regarded as almost platitudinous. He's left behind his name as a new word in the English language, Wellesian, meaning monstrous and unbelievable. But his triumph is that in his lifetime, the word has been made obsolete by the reality. Wells lived long enough to see that. In his last years, Wells preserved all the restless curiosity, the passionate enthusiasms of his great creative period. But there was nothing new that he had to say. His last books were probably embittered by growing physical weakness and the shadow of death. For him, Oscar Wilde's axiom was real. The tragedy of old age is that one still feels young. And Wells fought fiercely to keep his grip on the tide. So fiercely that he outlived by several years his own doctor's forecast. He took the trouble to improve his knowledge of the French language within a few months of his death, so that he could make a broadcast. Incidentally, he never made a success of broadcasting because his squeaky voice sounded absolutely terrible through a microphone. And when he was over 70, at an age when you'd have thought that human achievement could mean nothing more to him, H.G. Wells sat down humbly and wrote a scientific thesis so that the London University might be moved on the strength of it to grant him a doctorate. The only time that he seemed to weaken was a few weeks before his death, when a friend noticed that he was inattentive in conversation. Wells, aware of his lapse, squeaked out, "Can't you see I'm busy dying?" Most of the outstanding literary people in London wrote appreciations after the announcement of Wells's death. On the whole, I thought them lukewarm. The reason being that, as a personality, Wells could be so exasperating that most of his contemporaries had been angry with him at some time or another, and obviously couldn't quite forget it. Bernard Shaw was one of them. GBS's principal comment seemed to be the peevish one of how much more fortunate Wells had been than he had. Wells, said Shaw, had never starved or been penniless like Shaw. Wells had made a lot of money when nobody else would buy Shaw's books. It's a bit hard on Wells, the self-educated son of a handyman gardener and a cook housemaid, and to call him, as Shaw did, the most sensitive plant in the literary greenhouse. The fact is that both men rose to the top by incredible fortitude and determination. And in my view, Shaw is very naughty to say otherwise. Then Shaw likes being naughty. What nobody said on the death of H.G. Wells, what might well have been said, I think, is that Wells's going is the breaking of one of the last frail links in what in generations to come will surely be regarded as one of the greatest periods in English literary history. At the beginning of this century, when Wells was in his heyday, it's astonishing to remember how many undoubted literary giants ornamented the London scene. In the front rank with Wells, there was Shaw, Oscar Wilde, Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton, Rudyard Kipling, Thomas Hardy, Max Bibb. Only a little way behind him were men like George Moore, Robert Bridges, Conan Doyle, Arnold Bennett, Maurice Baring, Quiller Couch, Edmund Gosse, William Archer, Conrad, I'd nearly forgotten him, and a dozen more. World classics were published in magazines. Masterpieces were a commonplace of book publishing. And now, with Wells's death, of that amazing flowering of genius, only three are left. Shaw, of course. Hilaire Belloc, now a very, very old man with a long white beard, and Max Bibb. Max Bibb, well over 70, but as elegant and sophisticated as ever. When Max Beerbohm was in his early 20s, Oscar Wilde said that the gods had bestowed upon him the gift of perpetual old age. But now he's reached old age, Max seems to have discovered perpetual youth. He wrote an essay the other day for a magazine I'm editing, which is as brilliant and perfect as anything he's written in his life. And still, there can't be many years left now. And then what? I noticed that in one of your magazines, The New Republic, they said the other day that England, long declining into a second-class power, has begun her decline into a second-class culture. The article said that the fact that after 20 years of Shaw's dotage, as they called it, his birthday interview was still the event of the literary season in London, and that was something less than a sign of vitality. And I suppose they'll say that all the comment on the death of Wells, who was artistically dead 10 years ago, supports their argument. I wonder. I hope that the New Republic is wrong, for all our sakes, because culture in any country concerns all countries. Apart from that, I agree that the matter of whether England's culture is deteriorating is an interesting one. Certainly, there's a deterioration if you compare the reserve of literary genius Britain had 50 years ago and our relatively poverty-stricken situation now. But first, I suggest that at the beginning of the 20th century, our literature enjoyed a harvest which has only been equalled in two other periods, the Elizabethan and the late 18th century. Second, it's not an unimportant consideration, but for virtually 20 years we've been engaged in total war or living in the threat of it. If we're in the literary trough now, there's a good reason. And without prejudice, I'm not sure that any other country can do better at the present time. America has three big writers in Hemingway as a novelist, Edmund Wilson as a critic, and E.E. Cumming as a poet. But big as those men undoubtedly are, and by the way, I'm half inclined as a personal choice to include Dorothy Parker among America's greatest, personally, I can't rate them higher than, say, Aldous Huxley or Evelyn Waugh or the Anglo-American T.S. Eliot. On the whole, it's my belief that culture all over the world, not only in Britain, has the symptoms of the chaos and uncertainty of the present age. It'll recover, of that I'm sure, but at present there's no one to share an equal place on Olympus with a man like Herbert George Wells. He liked to be thought of, not as an Englishman, but as a citizen of the world. As a citizen of the world, we all owe Wells something of our gratitude. And now, this is MacDonald Hastings signing off from the British Broadcasting Corporation in London.